Welcome to Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. From the late 1940s to the early 1970s, the simmering funk and grooves of soul jazz evolved into one of the music's most popular styles, often driven by organ combos featuring guitarists such as George Benson and Grant Green. In the next hour, we'll hear recordings by some of the genre's leading artists and talk with veteran producer Bob Porter, author of the book Soul Jazz, Jazz in the Black Community, 1945 to 1975. It's Portraits in Soul Jazz with Bob Porter, coming up on this edition of Nightlights.
Thank you.
Charles Kennard, an aphrodisiac, with Houston Person on tenor sax, Grant Green on guitar, Jimmy Lewis on bass, and Bernard Purdy on drums. Once upon a time in Black America, soul jazz was one of the driving musical forces in the clubs and on the jukeboxes, in the record stores and on the streets, with good grooves and cooking lines that conveyed a blues-soaked vitality and formed a bridge from the R&B and jump blues of the late 1940s and early 50s to the soul music movement of the 1960s and beyond. Veteran record producer and radio host Bob Porter has written a book, Soul Jazz, Jazz in the Black Community 1945 through 1975, and offers his definition of soul jazz.
Soul jazz, I would say this, it's the music of the organ players, the tenor players, and the funky piano players from, say, late 50s to early 70s. That's the period of its greatest popularity.
Porter traces soul jazz's roots back to the mid-1940s when tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquette, who had first made a name for himself with his high-atmosphere soloing on Lionel Hampton's Flyin' Home, put together a popular octet often referred to as his Little Big Band.
Illinois was like the first star of the post-war era. He had come out of the Hampton Band, he came out of the Cab Calloway Band after that, joined Spacey in 1946 and makes a big splash there. But when he forms his own band in 1947, or actually reforms it because he had his own band in California before joining Spacey, that's a band that, you know, really created a lot of comment, a lot of stir, and he got an RCA Victor contract out of that. People don't realize what a big deal that was at the time, because RCA was far and away the biggest record company in the world. And for them to pick a black artist at that particular stage was rather unusual.
Jacquette and Flyin' Home Part 1, recorded with his so-called Little Big Band in July of 1945. While the brawny tenor saxophone sound of musicians like Jacquette would end up playing a significant role in the evolution of soul jazz, an even more significant factor was the ascendancy of the organ combo, fueled in particular in the mid-1950s by organist Jimmy Smith's great leap forward on the instrument, and by groups such as that of saxophonist Eddie Lockjaw Davis and organist Shirley Scott. Usually in conjunction with drums and sometimes a guitar or bass, these small groups gained great popularity both on records and in the clubs of the black community. Bob Porter on the reasons for the rise of the organ combo.
Obviously, one was economic. If you had an organ trio or quartet in a club where previously you might have had a 7 or 8 piece band, you're saving a little money on your musician costs. And if people liked the sound of the three or four piece band, the same way with a piano trio, you know, it doesn't cost you as much, but you, if they're as popular as the previous bands, they'll still fill the same number of seats. So I think one was economic. I think two was just, there was a sound there that you couldn't really get any other way.
The Front Room is proud to present America's most exciting jazz organist, Brother Jack McDuff.
We'll be right back.
Organist brother Jack McDuff and Rock Candy with Red Holloway on tenor saxophone, George Benson on guitar, and Joe Dukes on drums, recorded at the Front Room in Newark, New Jersey in 1963. Despite the success of soul jazz in the black community, it didn't always garner much coverage in the jazz press early on, as Bob Porter notes.
You know, you bring up an interesting topic because it's not one that's well explored in the jazz lore. I remember when I was a teenager, late teens, early 20s, I routinely went into black neighborhoods to hear jazz because the kind of stuff that I wanted to hear was only played there. You know, you will find, for example, and I use Willis Jackson as a perfect example of this. This is a guy who worked as much as any jazz musician in the country for many, many years. He primarily worked at Small's Paradise in Harlem and at the Club Harlem in Atlantic City. He played the summer season down there. But you didn't read anything at all about him. You know, he wasn't in the Downbeat listings. You know, they weren't doing feature stories on him. You know, he operated so far under the radar that, you know, when he started recording for Prestige, people thought he was a new artist, when in reality he'd been on the scene for a decade or more. Thank you.
tenor saxophonist Willis Jackson, and The Man I Love, with brother Jack McDuff on organ, Bill Jennings on guitar, Tommy Potter on bass, and Alvin Johnson on drums, from the prestige album Keep On a Blowin'. I'll have more soul jazz and commentary from Bob Porter in just a few moments. You can listen to many previous Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. Carry out and delivery information at 812-323-2233. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Portraits and Soul Jazz with Bob Porter on Nightlights. Featuring soul jazz of the 1960s and early 70s on this edition of Nightlights, and talking with veteran producer and radio host Bob Porter, author of the book Soul Jazz, Jazz in the Black Community 1945 through 1975. Porter notes that jazz critics were slow to warm to soul jazz in its early days.
I know that Martin Williams didn't like Gene Ammons. I remember that. Martin Williams is a very perceptive critic, and he was usually right, but he was not right about Gene Ammons. I think that, to a certain extent, Jimmy Smith was viewed as a fluke, you know, prodigy. Because he was on Blue Note and because Blue Note was promoting him and people respected Alfred Lion, you know, he probably got more attention that way than other artists would have. Now, Shirley and Lockjaw, that's a band that came out of Harlem. That's a band that came out of black neighborhoods. Esmond heard them for the first time, I believe, at the Apollo Theater. And, you know, waxed very enthusiastic to Weinstock about them. Weinstock didn't even want to sign them exclusively. But, you know, I think that once you begin to get a second generation of players coming down the pike, a Johnny Hammond Smith, you know, a McDuff, people like this, people who are more 60s than 50s, say, you began to, they had to pay more attention to them simply because the labels were recording them. Now, I can remember John Wilson hated organ groups. He hated organ groups and hated Sonny Stitt. And Dowbeat would routinely assign him to review Sonny Stitt organ records. I don't know why they did this, but it happened for years. And you could almost tell what he was going to say. You could almost quote the review from the last one that he would use again for the new one. Remember that soul jazz as music is as much rhythm and blues as it is anything else. I mean, if you want to break down its components. And rhythm and blues is not highly thought of in downbeat circles, shall we say. It's somehow or another was dance music for the masses rather than for the intellectuals, you know. I understand the point of view, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with it. The whole reason I wrote soul jazz was I didn't think the whole story had been told. You don't see a great deal of variation in writing jazz history any longer. You know, and this is, I mean, I think you would admit, or at least I hope you would do, that this covers a side of the coin which really hasn't been exploited before. Thank you.
saxophonist Gene Ammons and the Black Cat from a record produced by Bob Porter after Ammons returned to the jazz scene at the end of the 1960s, following a long absence brought on by a prison sentence for drug possession. Though record sales were clearly of economic importance to artists, producers like Porter, and the record labels, you could find the soul jazz scene at its most vibrant in the clubs. Porter frequented two clubs in Newark, New Jersey in particular.
I was working at Prestige. The two main clubs in Newark were the Key Club and the Cadillac Club, and they were right across the street from each other, on the corner of Williams and Halsey Street in Newark. And they each had the same policy. No cover, no admission, no minimum. You paid for what you drank. And I loved that corner because that's where I wanted my bands to play, because they had to work and they had to be good down there. The theory being that if the audience didn't like what you were doing, they'd simply get up and walk across the street.
We'll be right back.
Saxophonist Lou Donaldson and the Scorpion, recorded live at the Club Cadillac in Newark, New Jersey, with Fred Ballard on trumpet, Leon Spencer Jr. on organ, Melvin Sparks on guitar, and Idris Muhammad on drums. Soul jazz would peter out across the course of the late 1970s and 80s, a victim of changing musical trends and environments, though it remains an influence on modern-day jazz artists and retains a cult following among listeners around the world. Bob Porter's book Soul Jazz brings us many of the musicians and much of the history of a long-gone scene, a scene that he evokes as he recalls one of his favorite organ rooms in Newark.
If you went into the Key Club in Newark when MacDuff was in there with a good group, okay, on a Saturday night, they would lock the doors, which meant you couldn't get in, but you couldn't get out either. And the place would be so packed you couldn't move. You know, that kind of thing just disappeared. I think the club, the jazz club, if you will, was also a social headquarters. You know, soul jazz had, was like the preferred social music of black adults, in the sense that you could come into the Key Club, as I say, and that's one of my favorite clubs in Newark. And you could see Dionne Warwick or Sarah Vaughan hanging out at the bar with some friends, you know, things like that. You could see politicians. You could see drug dealers. You had the whole scene there. Now, they weren't necessarily there to listen to the band, although they could listen to the band if they wanted to. They were just there just to hang out. It's where people went, you know, if they wanted to go out to the place, well, I'll go down to the club. Thank you.
Thank you.
I closed with organist Charles Erlin performing Key Club Cookout with Grover Washington Jr. on tenor sax, Maynard Parker on guitar, Gary Chandler on trumpet, Jesse Kilpatrick on drums, and Buddy Caldwell on congas, recorded live at the Key Club in Newark in 1970. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Nightlights. Special thanks to Bob Porter and Casey Zakin. You can listen to many previous Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Production support for Nightlights comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com. And from the Laughing Planet Cafe at the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington. Carry out and delivery information at 812-323-2233. Nightlights is a production of WFIU and part of the educational mission of Indiana University. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.